Good evening and welcome to another episode of Inside the FLX. I'm Josh Durso and we are coming to you from the FingerLakes1.com studio in downtown Seneca Falls. We have a very exciting show today as Waterloo Town Justice Christopher Folk joins us in studio to talk about his career, a variety of local issues, and much more. Thank you very much for stopping in today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Josh.
So, first off, tell us a little bit about yourself. You have a very diverse background. Talk to us a little bit about your career, educational background, and how you wound up the Waterloo Town Justice.
Certainly. It is, as you say, somewhat interesting. I actually grew up in the area. I grew up in Seneca County. Attended Cornell University, did my undergraduate work there. Following Cornell, while I was at Cornell, I went into the technology track. Uh-huh. So I was involved in the Network Operations Center at Cornell, and that kind of evolved into a job out in California. So I spent a little over a year out in California, and at that time made the decision to relocate actually to the Boston, Massachusetts area. And then we came kind of to a critical juncture, if you will. My wife and I, we had four kids. We had to decide, you know, did we want to put down roots in the Boston, Mass area, a more metropolitan area, or do we want to think about relocating back to an area that was a little quieter, perhaps a little bit better, if you will, to raise a small family? We ultimately made that decision. It's a decision we certainly have not looked back on or regretted. Since moving back, I actually completed a master's in computer information systems. Additionally, I'm about 12 credits shy of an MBA at Northeastern. And I just finished up my second year of law school at SU College of Law. So I'm two-thirds of the way done in that endeavor. And having been back for a few years, I was approached by the local committee, and they were interested in putting forth some candidates. And actually, the initial position was for town council. And, you know, my wife and I kind of told me the idea, and we decided that, you know, we'd push forward. It ended up being an opening for a town justice position as well, and I decided to go that route. Kind of always had an interest in the legal field, hadn't really been exposed to it at any level, mm-hmm. but I decided it was, you know, it was time to step back, get back to my community. I was elected in 2011, took office in January 2012, and I was actually just reelected last year to another four-year term.
Now, what was the sort of, mindset shift moving from out in California to Boston and then back to where you originally started in Seneca County? How was that sort of how was the change felt personally? I mean, that must have been a major shift going from Boston to Seneca County.
Well, it certainly was, you know, in the move from Seneca County to Tompkins County at Cornell, and then out to California, you know, I was kind of at the point in my life where I kind of wanted to experience more, gain a little more diversity. Mm-hmm. So I spent some time out there, obviously, you know, very different environment. I was just south of L.A., mm-hmm. You know, millions of people, obviously, huge metro area and a mm-hmm. whole different landscape, you know, beautiful, warm, sunny days, but it was brown everywhere. There was no grass. There was no green. And then going back to Boston, my wife is actually originally from Western Mass, mm-hmm. and I found a company when I was working out in California that I came back and worked for in Boston. So, you know, again, more of a metro area, but a little bit more relaxed, if you will, than mm-hmm. Being right in the L.A., the center of things. You know, and we were in it. Things were going well. It was an interesting experience, obviously immersed in technology. And that was kind of, you know, at the point where technology was beginning to look more at remote workers. And they were mm-hmm. beginning to leverage the advantages of not having to invest in infrastructure by having the large buildings and the overhead, and by allowing workers to operate in remote facilities. Mm-hmm. So I kind of took advantage of that. I was kind of at the forefront of that. I was one of the first in my company. I worked for EMC at the time. They had about 25,000 employees then, and I think now they're somewhere around 45,000 to 50,000, so they've grown substantially. But they've kind of, you know, a lot of tech companies have really leveraged that, being mm-hmm. able to put workers in a remote site so they can take advantage of their own resources. They can be close to family and friends. And, you know, that was really where we were. So it was a little bit different. It was a little bit different coming back to Seneca County. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues I faced as a tech worker was the lack of high-speed infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So certainly there were some technological hurdles that I had to overcome. You know, I was running multiple systems. I had my own in-house network. There was a lot mm-hmm. of things I had to do to kind of make things work. Mm-hmm. But we did it. And it was a good experience, I think. It was nice that the kids were able to grow up in a more subdued environment, a more nurturing environment, a little less busy than a metro area.
Now, one of the things that has been talked about a great deal over the last several months, Senator Nozzolio deciding to not run for re-election. Your name has been one that has popped up several times, nothing official, but your name being a justice and in the heart of the 54th district. Any truth to that? Anything you'd like to say regarding that at this point? Or are you still sort of evaluating things or not even in the present?
Certainly. Well, let me just state, you know, clearly, unequivocally, as indicated, I'm a sitting Waterloo Town Justice. And I will state, for the record, at this point in time, I am neither a candidate for a primary or general election for any non-judicial office. Furthermore, I'm not now, nor have I made a public announcement for any candidacy. I am not seeking, nor have I authorized solicitations for contributions on my behalf.
Yep.
So no, at this time, I am not a candidate.
No. So as a sitting justice, you are at the forefront, I would say, or as close to the forefront as you could possibly get to the heroin epidemic that has really been seeming to get worse and worse by the day. What has your perspective been on that, not only just as a sitting justice, but also watching it sort of develop over, the last 10, 15 years?
Certainly. You know, and as you state, that's a pervasive problem, and it's affecting small communities, large communities. It's not discriminating. It's affecting across the board. You know, and as a judge, sure, I see the case. I see that, you know, case by case where there's an individual that is suffering from addiction. Some of them want to get help. Some of them prefer not to get help. They're just not at that point in their lives. But you see the effect both on the individual, and then you take it a step further, and you see the effect on the family. The family members come to court. You see they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the burden. Sometimes the individual isn't ready for help, but you see the way it's affected their family, their friends, and then even broader, you look at how it affects the community. So when you have that, you have a lot of ancillary effects. So you don't have just have, and you know, one thing that's important, I think we need to realize that the users, the addicts, their family, the community, we need to perceive them, and in fact, they are the victims in those cases. You know, the suppliers, obviously, is a different outlook. But the people that are using, the people that have become addicted, either through overuse of prescriptions or going down that avenue, and the fact that the prevalence of the oxycodone, which was then taken off the market, and now you have heroin, which has the same addictive characteristics. However, it's far cheaper. It's easier to obtain. People are getting that. They're using it. They're becoming addicted. And you need to kind of take a step back and look, you know, they're the victims here. And, you know, what are we doing to help? So as a judge, you try to do what you can on a case-by-case basis. You try to work with people. You try to make offers for more of a rehabilitation-type setting rather than incarceration, because incarceration ultimately isn't highly effective.
Now, do you think that is something that needs to be explored more on the systemic level, is actually working towards a rehab, some sort of result that incorporates rehab instead of sort of, because I'm sure not every judge is looking at it that way, and sometimes the person is sort of forgotten in the system, so to speak. Do you think there's improvement that can be made there, or do you think it's sort of something that has to work itself out?
Well, I certainly think there's room for improvement. I think one of the things we want to do is make sure that we have facilities that are co-located within the communities. So again, a lot of the burden is borne by the family and friends. So when you have the person that's ready to get help and then ready to go into a rehab setting, oftentimes it's 30, 40, 50, 100 miles away, and then a lot of that burden shifts to the family. And I think one of the key things is once they've gone through rehab, they need to build a support network so that when they come out, they've got viable options, they've got people that are there to support them. And if you're able to put that within the community, then people are able to be part of that whole process, part of the building of the support network, and are able to be more of a long-term rehabilitation. Because unfortunately, the addictive nature of opiates is so drastic that you have a very high recidivism rate amongst users. And anything you do to build community bonds to make people personally invested in the outcome is certainly going to be beneficial in the long run.
One other, speaking of community outreach, criminal justice has sort of, I guess, taken a perception hit over the last several years between police officers and the court system and incarceration, different things like that. What do you think is sort of the answer for this perception problem? We've had a lot of members of law enforcement on this program, and they always say that they're constantly trying to build relationships with the community. But is there something more that can be done on the systemic level to sort of help that along, help that process?
Certainly. And, obviously, in my role, I deal with a lot of law enforcement from various agencies. And yeah. There's good law enforcement and there's great law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And you see, you see all that. And you see that the fact that they do want to reach out. And I think one of the keys there is we've got a definitely a perception problem. We've got an us versus them, and it should be just an us. I mean, ultimately, the community, the members, the politicians, the judges, law enforcement, they're part of the bigger piece of the puzzle, and they need to work together cohesively to strengthen community relations. And I think one thing you can do is try to bring in, so as you said, community relations, bringing in local police force, getting them in the community. I think one of the things that helps is the school resource officers. Mm-hmm. So the kids are seeing them, they're interacting with them. I think it's important rather to have interactions outside of, say, a traffic stop or something that's more on the negative side, and have positive reinforcement between the community and law enforcement to show that there is that bond and that people are working together and they're really looking for the common good.
Now, do you think that's something that has to start at a young age, that interaction, to sort of ensure that it's a lifelong bred kind of thing? Because I think part of what we've sort of been seeing in the communities, not just locally, but all around, that led to this perception problem was that it wasn't until these kids, young adults, were, 18, 20, 25 years old, they're finally having an interaction with a member of law enforcement, and bam, it's them getting arrested. Is the key really just starting when they're young?
I certainly think that's very important, to be able to have those interactions at a young age, to be able to see that, it's not just a badge or a shield or somebody in a uniform. It's someone that's doing that in order to help the community, and they're doing it to benefit the community. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it under self-serving interests. They're doing it to further the community and to benefit, them in the totality. So I think if you can do that at a young age, if you can show them, look, they're just like me. They're part of the bigger thing. They want to help. They're here to help me, and I'm here to work with them. And you build that relationship. Now, certainly, it's more difficult if you introduce that at an older age, but I don't think that's an insurmountable hurdle. I think that still there can be community outreach. There can be interactions. There are communities where there are some divides between law enforcement and the community, and I think that can be gapped effectively, that bridge can be built effectively by bringing in those resources, showing them that, they're people, they're invested in the community, they're there because they want to improve it, and they're not simply there to do a purely policing function, if you
will. Yeah. So one of the issues that I, in some ways, probably led to a number of these other issues, the economy, economic issues, you've got low-income issues, and you've got a number of things sort of leading to these bad roads that people can take. What do you think on the economic side, just as far as what can be done or what is being done that you like, that you've seen, and what is your perspective as a judge on that sort of process?
I think ultimately a lot of things come right back to the economic route. Mm-hmm. So when people have, lack of careers, lack of job opportunities, a lack of good perspective, then they fall back on, the tried and true. And when it becomes easier to take someone else's thing rather than be able to earn and get your own possessions, if you will, then that becomes a problem. And that's pervasive. And, one of the issues there is it kind of comes back to my tech background. Moving back here, trying to overcome the hurdles of not having high-speed infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I think, and I view high-speed infrastructure and the communications therein as really being a fundamental right. I mean, if you look back to when they rolled out telephone service across the U.S., there were households that were relegated to second-class citizenry because they didn't have access to basic communication services. And now, and as we see here, I mean, this studio is living proof, the fact that things are out on social media. They're being leveraged on high-speed networks, their ability to stream live, to download. People that don't have that capability are really missing out on a crucial media outlet, and I think they're being bypassed. And one of the things we can do is if we can build the infrastructure, if we can roll out basic communication services, then that also that helps not only the citizen in their consumption, but it also allows businesses to take advantage of that as well. So we have the ability to do remote workers. I mean, one of the things, for instance, right now, I did an externship in cybersecurity last summer in Washington, D.C., And I actually just got an update from the National Institute of Standards and Technology this morning. And there are approximately 300,000 unfilled cybersecurity jobs, and that's expected to grow to 1.5 million within the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge glut of unfilled, skilled technology jobs. And NIST, for instance, is trying to put in programs where they develop programs with high schools. They give them grant money. They allow educators to come up to speed on cybersecurity to then train high school students. And one of the things you'll see, like in the metro areas, D.C. metro area, there are high school students that are being trained in cybersecurity. Over their summer breaks, they're making anywhere from $10,000, $15,000 to $20,000 working in an apprenticeship type fashion for mm-hmm. cybersecurity companies. Now, I think that's a huge advantage. And one of the things we see is the students and the kids and the youth, almost everyone really across the board, is immersed in technology. Mm-hmm. It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's all around us. We really have no choice. It pervades every aspect of our lives. So if you can take something that they enjoy doing and you can leverage that and you can use that to build the economy, then I think you have, you know, kind of cliche, but it's a win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the last couple decades, really just a decade and a half, a little more than a decade and a half, technology has really aggressively grown. And even now, it's moving faster than I think most people realize. What has been your perspective as far as not just the person who worked in it, not just the person who is sitting judge, but also just the from the personal standpoint, are we keeping up? Is that are we actually keeping up with the pace of change, or is this something? Because you're talking about a lot of whether it's professional giving kids more opportunities, you're talking about a lot of things that, frankly, I don't think exist in a lot of places, like this region, for example.
Sure.
Is that something that has to be worked on at the systemic level, or is that something that should happen automatically?
Well, I think fundamentally it needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where we're going. Everything, technology, as I said, is pervasive, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely enmeshed. And we need to look at that both at the grassroots level, you know, getting local educators involved, reaching out to school boards, ensuring that there's those programs in place. And we've put a lot of money and effort into programs like the STEM program,
mm-hmm.
which are crucial. But, you know, let's add the other piece. Cybersecurity is huge. And one of the things you said about, you know, the pace of technology. Look at the OPM data breach, the IRS data breach. This is huge, you know, 26 million records
mm-hmm.
of immense personally identifiable information that has been exfiltrated perhaps to outside countries or most likely to outside countries. You have a huge issue, and you know, a lot of people just don't understand. They don't understand that their data is everywhere, that the little mm-hmm. Store cards they fill out, that data is being tracked, it's being mm-hmm. monitored. And it's out there, and it's not necessarily secure, and people don't really understand how to secure it.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can get, you know, the new generation involved in it, if we can get mid-career people that want to make a switch involved in it, then we can take advantage of the unfilled jobs, we can do mm-hmm. the training that's necessary, and we can try to come back in and match pace with technology and where it is now.
Now, what do you think the big or, say, the big three issues are facing the region as a whole? What are some of the... As a guy who sees the crime side of it, but also the sort of process on the outside after they're released, after they're back into the public, what are the challenges, the big challenges facing whole region?
Certainly. Well, you know, I think overall we've touched on it already, but it's the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fundamentally, unless we're able to grow the economy, the expenditures aren't realistically ever going to decrease. When you look at something like the tax cap, mm-hmm. and the formula approach, I mean, you look at that as an arbitrary force being imposed on market conditions. And when you say, look, we're gonna keep this to 2% or 3%, I view that as, you know, you got a patient that's bleeding and you put a tourniquet on him.
Yeah.
All right, you still have to take the next step. You know, what's next? The tax cap was great. We needed relief. The tax burden is oppressive. It's affecting all of us. Homeowners, taxpayers are being stifled by that.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at that and say, well, okay, so we've got the tax cap. You know, that was a great first step to try to stem some of that bleeding. But then you say, you know, what are we doing about critical infrastructure? What are our needs? Have we assessed them? What do we need going forward? And would it be more practical to obviate the tax cap for a 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 year time frame
mm-hmm.
so that we can build the infrastructure, we can mm-hmm. bring the companies in, we can increase the economy on the revenue side, If we can leave expenditures the same or slightly decrease, then overall we've progressed. And then we can look at actually decreasing the tax burden on a more longer term scale. So I think, you know, the economy, which really ties into the tax burden, which also ties into government regulation. My wife had a small business in this area, and the amount of oversight, the amount of paperwork, the burden on a small business owner is significant, to say the least. I mean, that's a huge issue. And there really aren't a lot of grassroots agencies that are able to step in and say, you know, so you want to start a business, you know, do X, Y, and Z, fill this out. I mean, you have to bring in an attorney. You need an accountant. All these compound the issues. When you have that much regulation that's stifling the ability of small businesses to create and flourish, then I think that also pushes economic pressures on the region, which are negative. And then, you know, the whole personal freedom thing, which really ties back into regulation. So, you know, we want government to be there when we need it, but we don't want it to be in our lives all the time. I mean, it should be an aide. It shouldn't be an overseer and a manager of everything we do in our lives. So, you know, I think those are huge. And then you look at, you know, I guess the third thing, it's unfortunate, but what really impacts us is the opiate epidemic and the fact that the addiction is rampant. It's affecting the economy. It's affecting the criminal justice system. We see a lot more cases there, a lot more people. It's having an overall overwhelming negative effect on our region.
Now, looking specifically at smaller communities, smaller rural communities, we'll say, like a Seneca Falls or a Waterloo, what are sort of some of the unique challenges that you see them facing that perhaps, you know, you go a little bit west and you're in Rochester or you're in Syracuse and you don't actually see the same types of problems? Are there certain unique problems in a place like Waterloo? I know in the last couple of years, Lee Bieber has really been developing or trying to develop quite a bit in downtown. The downtown space seems to be one area where a lot of improvement is needed because there are a lot of, you go to Clyde, you go to these surrounding communities and there's vacancies, there's empty storefronts. What is the combination, I guess, for the smaller communities that the larger aren't having to deal with?
Certainly, and I think a lot of that, you know, not to overuse this, but it really comes back to the technology and what do we have for high-speed communication and what do we have that we're providing to people. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a more rural community, you know, even though Waterloo and Seneca Falls are obviously more centric, when you go to the outlying places, they may not have basic internet access. Mm-hmm. They may not have the tools that, you know, the city of Canandaigua, the city of Geneva, you look at Monroe County, Tompkins County, they're not facing some of those issues. They have a pervasive, overreaching infrastructure that gives people this basic fundamental access to technology. And when you talk to somebody from there, you know, they take it for granted. You walk around, you've got cell signal, you've got data. There are places you drive through Seneca County, you drive through Wayne County, you drive to various other places. You may not have any cell phone signal at all, let alone data.
Yeah.
You know, and these are things that, you know, they're affecting us. And you look at it, you know, also if you take an upstate versus a downstate, you talk to people downstate, you know, they don't get the concept that there could even, you know, a dead zone. What is that?
Mm-hmm.
There is no concept of a dead zone in New York City. I mean, everything, technology touches every single point. Everyone is connected. That's the world they live in. Everything is right there. The infrastructure there. I mean, going back to infrastructure, we've got places in the southern part of the county that don't have basic water and sewer services.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're just now in 2017, 2016, running water and sewer out to where the new casino is being built. We've got the whole 414 corridor that's been underdeveloped, and we don't have the basic infrastructure there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it'd be, certainly be my hope that when they're running the water and sewer, they're also laying down some dark fiber.
Mm-hmm.
So we have that as well. So I think, you know, that's one of the things. And you see the out-migration. You see people, you know, like my kids, for instance, the youth. They're here, and you want them to be here. It's a wonderful place to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what are their long-term prospects? Okay, my two girls are interested in technology. You know, what's here for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be great if they got into cybersecurity, but currently there's nothing here. They're going to have to go to a metro area. They're going to have to go to a Rochester or Syracuse or D.C. or New York City in order to take advantage of those skills. And when you have that, people leave, and then you're faced with downtowns that have empty buildings. You're faced with malls that are empty. Look at the Cuga Mall, for instance. I mean, you see structures all through the place that simply are being underutilized. They're not to capacity, and people have simply left. we're facing an out-migration problem where people that have, you know, good paying jobs, good careers, they live here, they work here, they retire, and then they're moving down south, mm-hmm. where there's less of a tax burden, where their dollar goes further, where the cost of living is far greater. And I think that's a fundamental problem. And, you know, people like Lee Bieber coming here, that's great that that investment is here, but we need to make sure we follow up and we back that up, and that we have the investment and we have the people coming in that are able to take advantage of these redeveloped areas.
Now, what has your perspective been seeing the progress out at the casino site, the Del Lago casino site? It's seen now that the legal troubles seem to be mostly behind the developers. What has your perspective been seeing that go up? Is that sort of a saving grace or a lifeline for future development?
Well, you know, I think it's critical that we develop. Having traveled the country extensively, you look around other areas like the South, for instance, and they have rapid development. I mean, mm-hmm. they've been building out North Carolina, Raleigh, Triangle Park area. They've been building out, you know, expanding everywhere. Even Rochester and Syracuse, you see expansion.
Yeah.
Now, the fact that the casino is the first expansion I've seen in Seneca County since Lowe's, I believe,
yeah.
you know, that's a long time span. Mm-hmm. I think it's important. It's critical. But I think it's only a first step.
Now, yep.
If we're looking at adding 1,800 to 2,000 jobs, that's fantastic for our region.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic for the county. It's fantastic for the community to build that in, to have that additional revenue, to have places where people can go to get good jobs. But we need to look at that as a first start. We need to take that to the next level. We need to look at expanding on that and further development and bringing more businesses in. Not that it's a lifeline, but it's certainly a start. It's the preserver's been thrown in. We need to grab it and then hoist ourselves into the boat and carry on.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on. This half hour has gone really quickly.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on, and we will definitely be having you on again in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. I'd like to thank Christopher for stopping by and wish him the best of luck with his continued work in Waterloo. As a reminder to our viewers, Inside the FLX airs Sundays at 7 p.m. on Time Warner Cable Channel 12. And as always, the latest news, updates, and podcasts are just a click or touch away with the Finger Lakes One app. It's available on Apple and Android devices. For Waterloo Town Justice, Christopher Folk, I'm Josh Durso, reminding you to join us next week on another episode of Inside the FLX.